Good morning. I see everyone's still waking up. No worries. So I'm David Rice. Nick, thank you so much for that generous introduction. Thank you so much to GovCert for the invitation to speak about something that's very close to my heart. So when we start talking about software, we quickly fall into the notion of technology. And that's all right. But software isn't about technology. Software, ultimately, it's about us. Ultimately, it's about us. So when we look into the realm of software, Nick said it best. You don't have to be an IT expert to understand software security, nor should you be. And this is an important focus in this talk, because that's exactly what we need, is market participants to understand the nature of security without having to be an expert. Now, there's something very real that we learned about software, and it's this. So this cartoon, I think, sums it all up. And of course, at the very top, it says, bringing civilization to its knees. And then you see the Goths, the Vandals, the Huns, and they're hack, hack, hacking. And in the lower right-hand corner, we have someone not as burly. And those are the geeks. And they are hack, hack, hacking. Now, this cartoon was put out in the year 2000. It was very evident to a cartoonist the nature of insecure software. And of course, we've been reaping the consequences ever since. So this talk really isn't about that the world will end because of bad software. This is not about the end of the world. This talk is about its beginning, or the beginning of a new world. And of course, the beginning starts with very, very simple stories. So we'll talk about the baker, the glassmaker, and the tailor. And we'll look at the incentives of the software market. We'll look at the basics of economics and the basics of social sciences and see how that applies into the cyber spectrum. So, a very simple story. And it goes something like this. Once upon there was a baker. And this baker made wonderful pastries and wonderful bread. And one day a vandal came along, threw a rock, and broke a window. And of course, the baker ran out, yelling and screaming, tried to catch the vandal, but didn't. And the vandal runs away. And of course, all the neighbors hear the baker's yelling. And they come out and they all shake their heads and say, "This is a horrible thing, horrible thing. How could someone ever do this?" Now, human nature is such that we tend to start looking for the bright side of things, no matter how tragic the situation, whether it's a hurricane, a terrorist attack, an earthquake, whatever it happens to be, very quickly, humanity's psychological immune system kicks in, and we start looking for the brighter side. And the brighter side is this, and they say, well, but for this broken window, the baker wouldn't have to go to the glassmaker. And now the glassmaker has to make new glass. And that's a good thing, because that money goes to the glassmaker, and that glassmaker now has money to go buy things that they want, or to go shop at other merchants. And that's a good thing. So actually, as opposed to being a vandal, this individual who broke the window was actually a benefactor. Now, it seems kind of crazy, but that is still a very prevalent mindset, even in the press. They see disaster, catastrophe, damage as a potential economic benefit. Now, what we don't see in this story, though, is the thing that is never created. Remember, the story is about the baker, the glassmaker, and the tailor. Now, of course, in this story, you didn't see the tailor. Why? Because that what the tailor makes never appeared. And good economic policy is not about the immediate effects only. It's about the immediate effects and the long-term effects of which you cannot always see. It's not so much what is created, the glass. It's what goes uncreated, which is the tailor's suit. So the baker now has a fixed window and no new suit, because the money that the baker would have put to the new suit now went into fixing the broken window. And because of that, the baker and the village is just that much more poor. What has happened here is that a demand for something new has been transmuted into a need, replacement. And what that does is destroy wealth. It destroys wealth. And this is a very, very simple economic lesson. Now, as I said before, in many instances, you still see this reported in the news. Now, luckily, the superstorm of 2007 here in Europe, I did not see, or I could not find, a press individual saying that economic or disaster was good for the economy. However, you do see lots of research papers out there saying, oh, well, you know, disaster is actually good because there's a lot of business that's generated. And it's true, there is a lot of business generated, but what you don't see are the things that are never created because of it. And that's hard, because we're very good at seeing that which is in front of us. It's very salient. It's very immediate. But it destroys wealth, ultimately. Now, what's the economic lesson here? Broken windows always, always destroy wealth. They're never good for us, okay? Why wait for Mother Nature? If broken windows were good, why not just go to your car and smash it? Don't wait for Mother Nature. Don't wait for the vandal. Do it yourself, and you're helping the economy. Now, of course, that's ridiculous. And it's important to acknowledge that as ridiculous, but the conventional wisdom doesn't recognize that often. So, the other thing is that people are spending just to regain status quo. They're just buying what they already had that was destroyed. So it takes a demand for something new and transmutes it into a need. And need doesn't create wealth. Demand creates wealth, because with your extra capital, you can go buy a new suit, a new DVD player, a new Blu-ray player, go see another movie, and that creates demand in other parts of the world. Now, to hang some numbers on this, pardon me, in September 11th, we know that it cost the United States thousands of lives. We know that it cost the United States $80 billion. But what is not regularly reported is that it pushed 11 million people in the developing world back into poverty. They were making more than a dollar a day, and they got shoved back into the squalor of poverty. That is the impact of disaster. It's what you can't see. Why? Because all those jobs those individuals could have had were vaporized. And that's bad for everyone. So, the other aspect of this lesson is that the real cost of something is not what you pay. It's what you give up in order to get it. So, the broken window didn't cost the baker $100. It cost him a new suit. It also cost the village another unit of wealth. So this is very important. But the broken windows aspect doesn't have an economic, or does not have an economic aspect alone. It also has a social aspect. And two criminologists by the name of Kelling and Wilson noted this. They said that small elements of disorder, if left unrepaired, lead to greater elements of disorder, even crime. And so it starts with something as simple as a broken window. If left unrepaired, it sends a message, and it says, no one's in charge of this house. And what happens? Most likely another window is broken. And then if that house becomes decrepit, the lawn isn't cut, there's graffiti on the side of the house, that sends a message to the neighborhood. And it says, well, not only does a homeowner not care, but neither do the neighbors. And so more vandals start coming in. Then you start seeing more graffiti. Then you start seeing petty theft. And then you start seeing more serious forms of crime. And so Kelling and Wilson said, don't go after the rapists and murderers. Go after the graffitiists. Go after those small elements of disorder. And that's, in fact, what New York City did in the 1980s. New York City subway systems were horrific. They were full of all sorts of crime, hoodlums, rapists, murders. It was unsafe to go there. It was costing the city of New York $120 million a year in lost revenues, besides all the other aspects. And what David Gunn, and William Bratton did was they fought not the murderers and rapists. They went after the graffitiists, the vandals. They went after the fare beaters. And what they saw in about a 10-year period was a 75% decrease in all forms of crime, particularly serious and violent crime. Now, this was unheard of to date, but we've also seen the same effect in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Atlanta, in New Jersey. So the broken windows theory actually has a lot of empirical evidence to support it, that if you go after the small elements of disorder, you actually disincentivize the more serious criminals because they know someone is in control. Someone cares. So what's the lesson here? Well, one, remove the signs of the disorder quickly, because people, as much as we love to see the goodness in them, are affected by environment. Anyone who's ever seen a mob knows this. A mob is typically filled of very, very good, very upstanding people. And yet they're a mob. That means that environment communicates to humans. The decorum is very important. And that message gets transmitted to us invisibly because we sense it. And when no one's in control, well, heck, if anyone who has kids, if they know that you can't control them, heaven help you, right? So the other aspect here is that strong law enforcement is not necessary. You don't have to have a draconian police state to have order. All you have to have is neighbors that care. In fact, you can reclaim a neighborhood with no police force. You can actually do it simply by cleaning things up. So there's an economic lesson here. One, broken windows destroy wealth. Two, broken windows incite disorder. Now, what in the world does this have to do with software? A tremendous amount. Because software isn't about technology, it's about us. It's about us. So, when we look at the temperature of the internet, so to speak, we see that it's rising. We see a 185% increase in new, unique malware out there. And the count isn't so important as it is the trend. All of a sudden, we hit a tipping point, and the sharks smelled the blood in the water, and they came for us. Now, of course, this is unique malware out there. This isn't necessarily a count of vulnerabilities, because I'm not going to focus on that just yet. What we see, though, is the message of disorder is clear and obvious to cybercriminals. They know no one is in control of software, and they're coming for all of that data that's stored on these computer systems that are rife with vulnerabilities. And we can see this in this report from Symantec. It says all these Trojan downloaders, all these aspects, typically at the bolding at the bottom, the initial stage may be installed by a web page that exploits a browser vulnerability, or a media player vulnerability, or an Adobe vulnerability, or you take your pick. The humans, no doubt, are being tricked. But you don't have to be stupid anymore. You simply go visit a website and you're done because they've exploited a JPEG or they've exploited a media player file. And it's all over. So, here's the larger story. Small elements of disorder lead to greater elements of disorder, even cyber crime, cyber terror, cyber warfare. Because those small, innocuous things we call bugs lead to more serious forms of disorder. And a hacker says, well, this is a bug. What can I do with it? And all of a sudden, that bug transmutes itself into a vulnerability. And that vulnerability leads to more discovery of vulnerabilities. Finally, we get defacements and break-ins of websites. Remember back in the 1990s, when website defacement was the only thing we had to worry about? But what happened? Well, this message was constantly transmitted out in the environment. It says, heck, if these 14-year-olds can get away with defacing a website, what can we, the more serious criminals, get away with? So a website defacement is nothing more than graffiti on the internet, and it sent a message. And of course, more serious criminals were not only attracted to, but were created by the environment. And it's a global neighborhood. You put bad software in Brazil, the Ukrainians see it. The Brazilians see it. The Japanese see it. We are in a global neighborhood, interconnected. That means the internet and all of its neighbors need to work together. What's the irony here? Cyber attackers don't break windows. They don't break windows. All they do is discover the vulnerabilities that software manufacturers fail to detect themselves. They're not taking a sledgehammer to a window. They're simply finding a defect that the manufacturer failed to detect themselves. This is the crazy thing, that the number of broken windows in any given software application is known, not only to the buyer, but also to the seller. If you ask a software manufacturer, how many vulnerabilities do you have? I don't know. They'll mumble something about perfect software as impossible. And that's understandable. But this is the big thing. Software manufacturing practices matter because software defines the very fabric and nature of the internet. Without software, the internet doesn't exist. It's just a bunch of cables. But software brings it to life. It creates the fabric that we use. So, the reality, I can pick numerous reports. Here we have both the Critical Infrastructure Report and Sandia National Laboratories, and they both say the same thing. We've got rife and chronic and pervasive vulnerabilities throughout all of our systems. And so it looks something more like this. Unrestrained vulnerability dumping onto other software market participants. So when we look at the image of pollution, if you don't pay the costs of pollution, why stop polluting? So all of these trends we see here are always on the uptake. And in fact, these are just the vulnerabilities that we know about. Now, this trend up here, if the laser pointer can highlight it, this trend right here looks like it's evening off. But attackers have gotten smart and they've stopped telling us about vulnerabilities. Because why report when you can make $1 million a month exploiting the system of your choice. So what we see here is an enormous vulnerability dumping. Here's the virtualization curve. Okay, in the early 2000s, virtualization wasn't very big. But what happened? All of a sudden, virtualization became popular, and all those latent defects started to come out. It's just unrestricted vulnerability dumping, and you crash test the software. And you also pay the expenses for all that crash testing. So what's the result? From a social aspect, we have more and more disorder. It promotes greater disorder, cyber terrorism. 2006 was deemed the year of cybercrime. 2007 was called the banner year for cyber espionage. Heaven knows what 2008 will be called. But we know it's out of control. The other thing is that it counteracts all of our self-protection mechanisms. Okay, people are putting in firewalls. They're building these enormous, expensive security architectures. And every day, bright, shiny new vulnerabilities are dumped back out of the market. And of course, our self-protection measures become less and less effective. Finally, law enforcement reacts to crime. They don't react to disorder. They react to crime. And so when we see a bot herder get caught, that's the exception, not the rule. Some studies show that less than 2% of cyber criminals will ever get caught. Well, heck, you have a better chance of getting a traffic ticket than getting caught breaking into a computer system. That's serious. That's a serious incentive for attackers. Finally, the economic aspect is devastating because every euro we spend on antivirus, on firewalls, on IDS, on vulnerability scanners is another euro we cannot spend on something else. That means buyers have fixed and protected or patched and protected software and no new suits, no new DVDs, no new cars. Wealth is transmuted into a need. In fact, wealth is destroyed. So I will be very explicit in my statement. Bad software destroys global wealth because it destroys the things we will never see. And because we never see them, we seem not to miss them. But people in developing worlds will. So how do we change the environment? Well, fighting cybercrime and providing or protecting economic growth means that we have to have software that is capable of withstanding highly foreseeable cybercrime activities. Highly foreseeable activities. It's a no-brainer at this point. You put insecure software out there, it's going to get compromised. It only matters when you start breaking about the 4% market share number. When you look at Apple, Apple ran a lot of great commercials that said, hey, look, we're a lot better than a PC, until they broke 4% market share. And then in 2006, Apple exceeded Microsoft in the total number of vulnerabilities reported. Okay, same thing with Firefox. We said, oh, Internet Explorer is a horrible browser. Go run to Firefox. And what happened 3 months later? Oh, whoops, vulnerabilities in Firefox. Now, of course, people are saying run to Ubuntu because it's more secure. It has less than 1% market share. Of course it's secure. No one cares about it except the people who have adopted it. So now how do we change this? How do we get better software? Well, it's important to realize that the market incentives are aligned against good quality, secure software. And it's more mainly here that you ask any software manufacturer, they are not trying to make bad software. These are good companies full of good people trying to do good things. Never mistake that. Software manufacturers are not to be vilified. They are good people trying to do good things, but the market incentives are aligned in such a way that it makes them very hard to give us what we need, because that's what markets do. They give us what we want, not necessarily what we need. So the current goodwill also of our vendors should be recognized. Microsoft has made amazing leaps to improve the security of their software. This should not be deprecated. It's important to realize the efforts of Oracle, Sun, Microsoft, they do care. But you know what? All of their efforts are unrelatable to anything else. What Oracle does has no relation to what Microsoft does. We have no concept of the depth and breadth of their testing, and we cannot compare apples to apples. That means their response is uneven and lumpy, and worse, from an economic perspective, inefficient, because they don't know if they're spending the right amount, let alone if we know they're spending the right amount. So how do we change this? Well, we have to look at the incentives. And this is a wonderful Dilbert cartoon that reminds us that incentives aren't a panacea, because you can even get these wrong also. And the Dilbert cartoon works like this. Our goal is to write bug-free software. I'll pay $10 bonus for every bug you find and fix. And everyone in the middle frame goes, yeah, woohoo! And on the last slide, it says, I hope this drives the right behavior. And the software developers respond, I'm going to write me a new minivan this afternoon. So we need to ensure that the incentives are correct, because we do get incentives wrong sometimes. So why do incentives matter? Well, because our entire lives are driven this. And economists call it utility. That is, they don't really care where you derive utility from, only that you get it from something. And the corollary, or the first assumption here is that you are always trying to make your life better off. Even if jumping out of an airplane makes you think that your life is better off for the jumping, economists will give you that, because utility is wherever you get it. So the problem here is that society is a morass of conflicting, misaligned, and sometimes contradictory incentives, which means you get to do stuff and it might hurt other people. So what are the incentives in the marketplace? These are just three, but there are many more. One, software manufacturers need market dominance. They crave market dominance. They need to get to the top of the pile faster than anybody else because it affords you enormous advantages. So the tendency here is to ship, then test. Ship, then test. Guy Kawasaki, a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, probably said it best. Don't worry, be crappy. Just get your product out there. Okay? They need market dominance. There's nothing wrong with that. They need to get there, but what's the impact? Well, manufacturers focus on what buyers can see. Defects are only discovered after the product becomes popular because security is not part of the beauty contest. That is, it's not part of the market competition. Also, buyers crave hyper-functional software. They want features, and there's nothing wrong with software manufacturers giving them those features. There's nothing wrong with that. But what's the impact? Well, the complexity of our software goes through the roof, which means it's even harder to secure. And then finally, cyber attackers are given a fresh new batch of vulnerabilities every single day. Patch Tuesday is simply a hacker notification system that over 200 million systems are now vulnerable, and they probably won't get patched in the next 3 months. It's a hacker notification system. Okay, what's the impact? Rampant increase in cross-border cybercrime, and we're out there buying yet another product to solve yet another security issue, and we increase the overall entropy of the system, which means it's harder and harder to make our security sustainable because it's a Rube Goldberg machine. It's got 18 working parts. No one knows what each one does. And then we hope we get security out of it. So we also have some perverse incentives. Perverse incentives are these. Perverse incentives are basically the law of unintended consequences. That is, we do one thing and we get a completely different result. And in this case, the perverse incentive is patching. That's right. Patching is a perverse incentive because while it may cost a software manufacturer $500,000 or so to make a patch, it's almost a near zero marginal cost. So if you look at this, the fixed cost right here on the right-hand side of the slide, the fixed cost of making any type of software, patch or otherwise, is very, very high. But how much does it cost to make a copy of software? We'll ask Napster or any of the eDonkey file sharing server systems out there. It's trivial to make a copy of software. So while it may cost the manufacturer significant and fixed costs, it's a marginal, low marginal cost, near zero marginal cost. But how much does it cost you to apply those patches? Well, on average, about $254 per machine, which means the more machines you have, the more expensive it is on a continuing basis. It may cost the manufacturer $500,000, but it will cost everybody else $50 million or more just to get those patches applied in the right amount of time. Now, that's not the worst of it. The next worst part is those licensing agreements. Because what happens is every time a new vulnerability comes out, a patch comes out, an upgrade comes out, what does this allow manufacturers to do? Renegotiate a contract you couldn't negotiate in the first place. Why is it that every time Apple gets another exploit in its QuickTime browser, I have the privilege of signing a new licensing agreement? But what this does is allow software manufacturers to optimize their market and legal protection. It's not like they're thinking that this will be good for them, but it does provide some type of an incentive because upgrade paths are very important. What's the biggest competitor? Microsoft Office 2007. It's not OpenOffice. It's Office 2003. Biggest competitor, Vista. It's not Red Hat. It's XP. So these upgrade paths are very important because it also allows a renegotiation of a contract you couldn't negotiate in the first place. Why create better software when I can just force you into a new version? It keeps those revenue numbers up. There's nothing wrong with this. Don't get it wrong. There's nothing wrong with this. It just creates some very uncomfortable situations. The next perverse incentive is perhaps worse and the most reprehensible of all the perverse incentives. And what is it? Configuration. Configuration is a perverse incentive. Why? Because the more configuration options I give software users, the more responsible they are for getting the configuration options correct, which means it further insulates software manufacturers. Because what becomes the focus of the marketplace? Compliance. Benchmarks. Did you configure your systems correctly? Now, this doesn't mean we shouldn't have configurable systems, but what it does mean is it creates an insulation around the software industry, which means everyone who buys software is accountable and responsible for any failures, whether it's their failure or not. And this is problematic because every time there's a new configuration option in your software, you accept, willingly or not, a quantum of liability. And this is why SOX, the Sarbanes-Oxley Acts, and other things like this are so reprehensible, because they ask of executives what the executives cannot ask of their software manufacturers. They must have systems that they can say they are assured, but an executive cannot turn around at a software manufacturer and say, insure me about your software. You get some mumbling about perfect software isn't possible. That is truly a perverse incentive. So, market failure. Well, the corollary to the first assumption that you always do something to make yourself better off, the corollary is that you won't do things that will make you worse off. Software manufacturers will not forego trying to get market share. They won't, and they shouldn't. Software buyers won't forego asking for features, and they shouldn't. And cyber attackers, as long as they are supplied with brand new vulnerabilities on a daily basis, they will not ever, ever forego attacking. Now, of course, even if we did have perfect software, the attackers would still come for us. So I'm not saying that perfect software will eradicate cybercrime issues, but you know what? It will get a significant message of disorder out of the environment, and that's very important. So how do we correct market failure? Well, usually we have market failure because the incentives are aligned in such a way that people cannot self-correct. They will not make themselves worse off. A software manufacturer will not forgo making more secure software if it costs them market share. They will not, nor should they. So how do we change this? Well, we start looking at the incentives. If we have new incentives, we'll get a new environment. We have to meet people where they are. We cannot vilify software manufacturers. We have to understand their incentives as well as the buyer's incentives as well as the hacker's incentives and look at the incentives, because incentives-driven regulation or oversight is far more efficient and far more fair to everyone than command and control regulation. That is, government shouldn't be involved in software manufacturing process, but government isn't involved enough right now. So let's talk about how we can meet the market where it is and transform things and get a new beginning. The two things we should realize here is that software, insecure software, should be more expensive to create than secure software. Right now, it's tremendously inexpensive to create insecure software, and so you get a lot of it. And secure software is very expensive. We need to invert that model. And then the other aspect of whatever incentive model we may choose is that buyers should have clear, observable, reliable signals regarding the assurance of their software. Now, if we look at the car, it took legal, regulatory, and legislative acts in order to get the safe car that we know and appreciate today, but it took us 80 years to get there. How long will it take for software? Your guess is as good as mine, but 80 years seems about right. So what's the example here? Well, in the United States, 90% of all vehicles are 4- or 5-star rated. That means that any manufacturer that insists on making a 1-star rated car will forego all revenues they could have had by making a 5-star rated car. It is actually a cleverly hidden, unsafe car tax, and the market enforces it. Government simply set the parameters. They said, these are what we require, the results that we require for safety. We don't legislate activities, we legislate results. That's very important. And so what happens here is that any manufacturer that chooses to make an unsafe car is taxed because the revenues they could have had are vaporized. It's the same thing as a tax. Now, what do we have for software? Nowhere near the same model. But the important thing here to realize is that these labeling things that we have out in the marketplace, whether it's Underwriters Laboratories, NHTSA, NCAP, even the fuel efficiency here in the EU, what it does is democratize the intangible. What it does is say, you don't have to be an expert about car safety, about fuel efficiency. You simply look at the label and you as the buyer make the decision. This is critical because private consumption within the EU is around 60%, depending on if you consider EU 15 or EU 20, or EU 25, 27. Okay? So depending on which statistic you use, private consumption is about 60%. In the US, it's 70%. Now, Bruce Schneier recently came out, a security expert in the United States, and said that government should really use its buying power in order to leverage more secure software. And he's right, but it's not enough, because the buyers have far more purchasing power than government will ever have, and that's the way it should be. Consumers have an enormous amount of power, and right now we expect them to be experts in security, and they will never, never, never be experts, nor should they. Security is not visible in the marketplace, and therefore no one can price it. You don't get what you can't see. If you can't price it, you don't know what you're getting. So we need to democratize security such that it's not just experts doing cybersecurity, it's more. So to wrap up, unrestrained vulnerability dumping hurts everyone, socially and economically. It devastates us, it destroys accumulated capital, and it inhibits global wealth. What's the numbers here? Hundreds of billions. I'm not going to hang a number on it because we can't right now. And then finally, we need to change the incentives. It's not about the technology, it's about the humans. It's ultimately all about us. It allows us to be more efficient in our market response. We should not prohibit insecure software, but we can price it. And that's fair, because an incentives-based model is the most efficient for everyone. And it says that, okay, if you spend $800 million, that's probably the right amount. Right now, we're spending wildly, and we have no idea. So my time is up. Thank you so much. I will take questions, actually, at an Ask the Expert session tomorrow, simply because we have Mark Sox coming on next, a wonderful speaker and a good friend. And so I also want to have his time also. So thank you so much for your time today. Thank you again, Gufser.
David, thank you so much. As you say, questions tomorrow at an Ask the Expert session. Let me just ask you this very, very briefly. I mean, do you see any real sign of a more enlightened approach?
I do. I see companies like Veracode, that they have a software assurance labeling system that's coming out. And this is rudimentary. We're going in the right direction. People in both European governments and U.S. governments are realizing that we need to do something. But this is nothing new. It's nothing new. We've faced these problems before, and we have solutions in front of us.
Okay. It's all about cooperation. David Rice, thank you so much. Let me give you that. That's a small token of appreciation. Thank you very much indeed. Well, yeah, indeed. Thank you, David. As if